You're listening to the Co-Main Event Podcast. And now your hosts, Ben Folks and Chad Dundas.
That's right. You're listening to another episode of the Co-Main Event Mixed Martial Arts Podcast. I'm your co-host from BleacherReport.com, Chad Dundas, and joining me, as always, from MMA Junkie and USA Today, it's your friend and mine, Mr. Ben Folks. Ben, UFC 214, just a little slice of heaven.
You know what? Kind of reminds you why you stay up all those nights watching some bullshit on Fox Sports 1, doesn't it?
Refreshing, you might say.
That's right.
Like coming back from college and having a piece of your grandma's key lime pie.
It's exactly like that. There could be no possible better analogy.
And you just remember what you've been missing. Surviving on dorm grilled cheese sandwiches and whatever they have at the food court.
And then, of course, she's also going to make you sit through some really boring roast beef or something in between slices of key lime pie.
Well, it can't all be dessert.
Let's make the analogy work.
It cannot all be dessert, right?
Unfortunately, it cannot, apparently.
We got a lot to talk about this week, Ben. We cannot sit here and exchange pleasantries about your road rash and how your off-season hockey conditioning program is going.
Well, it's too bad, because then I could tell people about the shin wound you suffered doing box jumps down at the gymnasium.
Yeah, got a couple of big scabs going on in the front of my leg area.
Do we need to look at your workout routine?
Lower anatomy.
Do we need to maybe reevaluate some things?
Maybe need to look at the size of the box. I don't know.
Yeah.
Maybe knock that down a few inches.
You know what? You got to push yourself, though, man.
I know. I'm pushing myself, and now my leg's all banged up.
How did you really bang up your leg?
Jumping on top of a box.
No, you were not.
That's the true story.
I was guessing at that.
Well, you were right.
Don't be jumping on top of boxes, man. That's just silly.
This episode of the Co-Main Event Podcast is once again brought to you by Battles of London, a company across the pond in England that truly makes MMA apparel for the well-rounded fight fan. Battles of London garments are cutting-edge sportswear pieces with contemporary designs created using Japanese-style fabrics while making sure that everything is hashtag ethically produced. The t-shirts are designed with the combat sports physique in mind, while the sweats are roomy and luxurious for the ultimate in post-training comfort. Also, they've got a new line of shorts inspired by Muay Thai trunks that you should definitely check out. Battles of London has tons of cool stuff going on right now. Ben, pull their coats to it.
That's right, Jed. Not only do they make elite clothing for combat sports aficionados, but they got their fingers in a lot of different pies. The guys who run the companies, they have backgrounds in men's lifestyle magazines, the MMA media, and fashion design. They wanted to create a fightwear brand with the same production values as designer labels, but they have diverse interests, just like the CME listening audience. For one thing, there wasn't really a print publication or website they thought totally reflected their values, so they went and started their own. Log on to battlesoflondon.com and click on the features section for articles on cutting-edge training and nutrition, fight psychology, some stunning BJJ and boxing artwork, and interviews with compelling voices from the fight world.
Issue 1 of the print magazine is out now with East London UFC middleweight Darren Springer Stewart on the cover, and it's also available from the website magculture.com. That's magculture.com. Issue 2 will be out in early autumn and will feature French UFC bantamweight Tom Firekick Kid Dukenoy. Is that how we're saying it? Dukenoy? We talked about this last time.
Dookie. I think we should go with Dookie, but
you got to say the whole name here in this part.
Firekick Dookie.
He'll be wearing the Battles of Paris capsule collection. Also a reminder that Battles of London will be out at Polaris, the world-class Brazilian jiu-jitsu card featuring Gary Tenon versus Dylan Danis on August 19th at the O2. You can stop by to see their booth, say hi, check out the new designs, and maybe get a comp patch for your gi or fight shorts. If you won't be in the neighborhood for Polaris, just go to their website, battlesoflondon.com. New features are regularly updated there. You can follow them on Instagram and Twitter at Battles of London. And of course, they're on Facebook. Whatever you do, always enter the promo code CME for 10% off your order. If you have a problem with anything or they're just out of something that you're after, you can always email info@battlesoflondon.com and they'll get it sorted out for you. Dundasso shirts are back in stock over at Cotton Bureau.
What?
And this time we've already got enough orders to go to print. More exciting news. I know you've been working on your beach body, Ben,
you know
all
that.
Summer.
That's a fact.
Now it's August, the dog days. You can log on to Cotton Bureau and go over there and pick yourself up a Dundasso tank top. Those are new this time
around. Okay. I assume that I better act fast because soon they'll be gone forever.
After this, we're probably done forever.
Yeah. That's a totally legitimate thing that I absolutely believe this time.
This is probably the last chance for everyone to go get their Dundasso tank tops.
Wow, that's serious business.
We got music again this week from our colleague in the MMA media, Eric Fontanez. You can find his writing over at bloodyelbow.com. And if you like what you hear, you can find more of his music at soundcloud.com/Eric Fontanez. Three rounds, as usual, this week in the co-main event podcast. In round number one, John Jones' rematch with Daniel Cormier was like the climax of a Shakespearean play, except nobody got poisoned or accidentally committed suicide. It was still pretty dramatic, though. And in round number two, hey, if you're Daniel Cormier, you can still beat up 7,443,999,999 members of the Earth's population. That is still pretty good. And in round number three, are they really going to have Johnny Bones fight the Beast Incarnate, the Dark Lord himself, the mayor of Suplex City, the pride of Webster, South Dakota, and current resident of Mayfield, Saskatchewan, mixed martial artist, professional wrestler, and professional football player Brock Edward Lesnar? God damn it, I hope so. All that plus Are You Fucking Kidding Me and Just Saying Stuff, but first, like we always do about this time, let's do a little bit of listener mail.
Listener mail. You think people are shocked right now going, holy shit, these guys are going to spend all three rounds on Jones-Cormier?
I hope so, because you know what we like to do?
We like
to give them different looks.
Yeah.
Flip it on their head. Just when they think they know the answers.
We change the questions.
We change the goddamn questions.
Think we're going to zig, we zag.
First question this week comes to us from Ivan Burden. He writes, is Tyron Woodley a great game planner or boring fighter? Is he Randy Couture, where he is amazing at neutralizing his opponent? Or is he Johnny Hendricks, where now that he has the title, he plays the points game instead of trying to finish the fight?
I don't know if he's either one of those, and I don't know if that's a completely fair assessment of Johnny Hendricks there. Because, I mean, give him credit, he did win that fight, and he won it in, I guess, the smartest way possible to fight a guy like Demian Maia. I don't know if I'm going to go all the way and say that was just brilliant game planning, because the game plan, as far as I could tell, seemed to consist of don't get taken down and punch him in the head enough. Punch him on his way in to make him think twice about diving in there on you. Punch him a little bit while you're standing up there, but don't go crazy trying to go out there and rushing forward at him to make it easier for him to take you down. I mean, it was pretty basic, but he executed it well. But I do think that there is something to that he's gotten too conservative approach now that he has the belt. Because, and he kind of said it afterwards, that basically, why should I go out there and take too many risks when I can beat him this way? And yeah, sure, you won the fight. There's no question that you won the fight. And yet, that might have been the worst UFC title fight I can recall. Can you remember a worse one? Or at least one that you felt less interested in as it was happening?
Oh, I'm tempted to say UFC 112, Abu Dhabi, Anderson Silva versus Damian Maia, right?
Okay, but that one at least was, like, weird. It was entertaining in that it was weird, and it was Anderson Silva doing this Anderson Silva thing again, where you're just kind of like, oh boy, here we go.
Right.
So there was precedent for that.
Well, and I want to talk about Tyron Woodley in a second, but since I just brought up Anderson Silva versus Damian Maia, this obviously Damian Maia's second UFC title shot in his second weight class, this one obviously going down at welterweight. How much credit can we just give Damian Maia for, while not going out there and winning and not necessarily even being competitive in this fight, but kind of scaring the shit out of UFC champions, right? Because, like, Tyron Woodley, maybe he could have, like, been more aggressive in the stand-up and ended up getting a finish via strikes with Damian Maia. But what was really going on here was Tyron Woodley being 100% dead set against ever, even for 1 second, winding up on the mat with Damian Maia, right? Because everybody knows if that happens, no matter how good you are, no matter if you know what's coming, Damian Maia can still stop you. So, like, we can complain about whether or not this fight was boring or whatever, but some of it is just because Damian Maia is a ground specialist, right? And no one wants to do that with him.
Okay, I mean, that is a very generous interpretation for Damian Maia to be like, it was boring because he's so terrifying to UFC champions.
But, well, a weird kind of terrifying. I'll admit that, right?
Well,
because he didn't seem that all that terrifying during the actual fight.
And people, I'm sure, afterwards when Tyron Woodley was catching a bunch of heat for this one, and people were like, well, what about Demian Maia? You know, what did he do? And that's a fair question to ask. The answer to it is what he did is exactly what you thought he was going to do, and exactly what Tyron Woodley thought he was going to do, and Woodley was ready for it. So after that point, though, when you have established, like, hey, I'm a better striker than this guy, so as long as we're standing on the feet, I'm not in any real trouble, and he is. I'm a better wrestler than he is, so his ability to get me into the zone that he needs to get me in order to, like, enforce the one aspect of the game where I'm worried about him, he can't even get there. So you're kind of in control of the fight there at that point with Tyron Woodley. You know, by round 4 or 5, it's very clear you are in control of this fight. And that's where I think you can criticize Woodley, is because when he was in control, when he had firmly established that control, he was very content to just say, all right, let's just take a foot off the gas. Let's put it in cruise control. Let's coast to the finish and get that judge's decision. And, you know, that's his right. I understand kind of the thinking behind it, especially if you're Tyron Woodley, because if you fuck around and you lose the belt to Demian Maia, the UFC is not giving you a rematch. There's no way they're going to let Tyron Woodley back into this position to get the UFC welterweight title if they have any other choice, because it just has not been a really successful title run from the box office perspective for the UFC. So he knows, like, if I'm going to make that money and make the most of this, I got to hold on to that belt. The same thing we kind of talked about with Amanda Nunes. The belt is all you have if you are one of those kind of fighters. And so I get it. He decided he's going to play it as safe as possible so that he keeps that belt. It's also just going to make people fucking hate you. And they're just going to hate to watch you fight.
Yeah, I feel like a broken record in some ways. I feel like I say this every time we get into one of these really weird, somewhat tepid fights. But, like, if the thing that mixed martial arts is a competition where you bring all of these people from diverse backgrounds and different skill sets and fighting styles, and you put them in this cage, and you allow them to have more or less free reign in terms of fighting each other. Obviously, there are rules, there are restrictions. We've all agreed that the combat will be hemmed in by this set of unified rules. But if you want to have this kind of open-ended competition between people from diverse backgrounds, and you want it to be on the level, that's sports, man. Every now and then you're going to get a fight that just stinks. It just happens. If you're going to have this wide-open competition, it's not all going to be scintillating action, especially when you've got a star-studded pay-per-view with 5 fights on it. One of those fights is just going to be grandma's boring pot roast before you get to the key lime pie.
And sure, I agree with you in a broad picture kind of sense.
Right.
However,
and once you see it, there's nothing wrong with saying that one was a stinker.
Right. I agree
especially
with that as well.
If you're paying $60 to watch it.
I also will look at the last 2 welterweight title fights and be like, a lot of pot roast going on here.
Okay. But
dry pot roast, not even enough gravy to go on the damn thing.
Yeah.
No, you're just choking it down like a mound of chalk.
You're right. But let me say this also before we get too far down the path of dumping on Tyron Woodley. Tyron Woodley knocked out Robbie Lawler.
True.
1 year ago yesterday.
Fact.
Not that long ago.
Okay.
He went out there and in the first round KO'd Robbie Lawler. And if you include that fight, Tyron Woodley has fought in a welterweight title match 4 times in 1 year, and 3 of those fights went the 5-round distance. So if we're going to give dudes like Demetrius Johnson credit for being workhorse champions for the UFC, even though Tyron Woodley may not be the UFC's favorite dude right now, 4 title fights in 1 year is a lot.
That's true.
I don't know that Robbie Lawler ever did that. I don't know that George St. Pierre ever did that. That is an almost... That's almost too much. Like, that is, you know, and especially if you give 3 of them are 25-minute fights back to back to back, even though the last 2 of those were not all that awesome. Like, I think we got to give Tyron Woodley credit for fighting as often as he has and, in his own words, taking on these 2 specialists in Demian Maia and Stephen Thompson. And now, you know, in the cage after it was over, he said he was excited to fight another freestyle fighter where he felt like he could show off more of his own skills. maybe if he gets into a fight against a different kind of guy, maybe it's less boring than what we have here in these most recent two.
Well, I sure hope so. And again, I think you raise good points, and I'm not saying to criticize Tyron Woodley because I think he's not a good fighter. I think he is an excellent fighter, which is one of the things that makes fights like that frustrating, because you get the sense, man, if you just decided to, you could go out there and just demolish Demian Maia. Like, he seemed like he was on the precipice of doing that at moments. And so his kind of refusal to do that, and then to afterwards stand there and tell us, you know what, I could go a couple more rounds, and everybody in the crowd is going, but please don't, no, God, don't even bring that, I don't even want to think about that.
Next question this week comes to us from Brian Van Dugel. That might be one you want to Google, I don't know.
Yeah, what club does he play for?
He writes, Tanya Evinger did what most people wouldn't. She took a fight with Chris Cyborg on short notice and at a higher weight class. She kept it relatively competitive for the first couple rounds. Can we all agree that the UFC should reward her with an immediate title shot at bantamweight against the winner of Nunes Shevchenko? But can we also agree that they will find some reason not to? Now, Ben, let's talk a little bit here about the Chris Cyborg, Tanya Evinger women's featherweight title fight. At UFC 214, Chris Cyborg ends up winning via TKO after a series of knees against the cage in the pretty much the opening stages of the third round, almost 2 minutes into the third round. This was a situation where I think both fighters lived up to their reputations, lived up to their billing coming in. Clearly, Chris Cyborg is the most dangerous and violent woman in mixed martial arts, and Tanya Evinger had a reputation for being wily and tough. And we knew that she was going to be Cyborg's most formidable opponent of the last several years. And in the end, I think we get what was essentially the expected result here. And,
well,
you know, if you can say anything negative about it, maybe it's that the fight itself didn't have too many highlight reel moments in it. But at the end, you put the 145-pound title on Cyborg, where I think we all have always thought she deserved to be, and you get Tanya Evinger now in the UFC, we hope, at least for a couple more fights, as I think an instant legitimate contender at 135.
Yeah, and it seems like the fans see a lot more potential for the UFC to do stuff with Tanya Evinger than the UFC seems to see. And I don't know if I would go immediately give her the winner of the next title fight. I'd give her another fight in that division, because it would be nice to see you fight in that division in the UFC once before you challenge for the title, maybe even ideally get a win before you just jump right into a title fight. But, you know, I wouldn't necessarily think that it was a miscarriage of justice to take Tanya Evans, or the Invicta FC bantamweight champ, and give her a shot at the UFC bantamweight title, because clearly she had to do this just to get in the UFC, which already kind of says something about maybe how the UFC views her, that she had to go up and wait to fight the scariest person in the division above her just to get them to give her a shot. And you're right that she showed the toughness that we expected, but she just didn't really have a whole lot of offense that she could put on Cyborg at. Didn't seem like she could really hurt her with punches, couldn't get her to the mat. And again, we talked about this beforehand, that it was a bad style matchup for her, because her game is built so much on this kind of bullying, grinding style of grappling, where she'll just get you down, wear you down, rough you up until you give her a submission. And you know, that's a tough thing to do against a much bigger opponent like Cyborg. But, you know, I think, you know, she was obviously disappointed in the performance, but making it to the third round always feels like you did something, even if you didn't do a whole lot of offense, which tells you right there something about how scary Cyborg is.
Yeah, and if I was reading it correctly, it seemed like a smart game plan and performance from Tanya Evinger. She seemed to hone in on some of Cyborg's tendencies. Like, if you watch a lot of those most recent Chris Justino fights, she really likes to back somebody up against the fence, and then when they run out of room, she kind of opens up on them with those strikes, and she just ends up battering them into a TKO situation. And it seemed to me like Tanya Evinger somewhat knew that was coming, so when she got hit by Cyborg, she would back up a little bit, and then when Cyborg would try to press the action, she would immediately clinch and try to trip her, take her to the ground, and get it into a Tanya Evinger style of fight. But at the end of the day, you're right, it just seemed like the fact that she was moving up from 135 to a different weight class was really apparent in those instances, because she just didn't have the size and strength to really take Cyborg down. And I think the one or two times that she managed to do it, she obviously just couldn't keep her there. And so, like, that is a good strategy. But if you can't get Justino down and you can't hold her there, it's a strategy that you're not going to be able to work for 25 straight minutes.
Yeah, well, I mean, to see what the UFC does in the future with Tonya Avenger, I think is going to be an interesting test for the UFC's ability to, like we said in the past, promote what's there rather than just take the one-size-fits-all approach to promoting fighters. Because there is a lot you can work with Tonya Avenger if you're willing to take the person you have and promote that person rather than trying to fit everybody into the same mold. Like, she's going to show up to the media day looking like she just got done hanging drywall with Tim Johnson. She's going to stand there with the reporters and tell them that now that she's in the UFC and people see her on TV, soon all these male reporters are going to find themselves single, and it's going to take a beat for them to realize that Tonya Avenger has just threatened to steal their wives and girlfriends. Like, that kind of stuff can be awesome, and you can really work with that and reach, you know, maybe even different audiences if you know how to use it. But it doesn't seem like the kind of thing that the UFC has been super interested in. The UFC seems like it's more like, hey, we'll take 10 Paige Van Zandts before we will work with one Tonya Avenger. So it'll be interesting to see if the UFC can actually do something with that.
Well, and the women's bantamweight division is in a little bit of a strange place here, just in terms of trying to figure out a next opponent for Tonya Avenger, because obviously you've got Valentina Shevchenko, who's your number one contender and is going to fight Amanda Nunes at the next pay-per-view. Then you got Holly Holm, who we all think is probably going to wind up in a 145-pound fight against Chris Cyborg. Then you got Juliana Pena, who seems like the kind of up-and-coming contender that you might not want to throw out there with Tonya Avenger, just because if Tonya Avenger wrestles her to the ground and beats her, like that's an obvious setback for Juliana Pena. Then you got Ronda Rousey, who is essentially retired. And then you get into this like Raquel Pennington, Sarah McMahon, Kat Zingano, Jermaine Durandamy territory where, you know, we think Kat Zingano could be a contender at 145 pounds. So when you try to figure out where Tonya Avenger fits in here, it's maybe not as cut and dried as you think, just when it comes to finding her an opponent. So it will be interesting to see what they end up doing.
Although, still, I would watch the shit out of Kat Zingano versus Tonya Avenger.
Sure, yeah, I think anybody would. Next question this week comes to us from Josh Monty. He writes, whilst my wife and I were watching UFC 214, she made a point I had not thought of during the Cerrone-Lawler fight. Those two dudes look a lot alike in the heat of an exchange. Both are bald, have tattoos, and wear a nice shade of red. Could this fact have confused the judges? Should at least one fighter be required to have hair of another or another defining trait? The fight was close to begin with, and I don't think this look alike helped the judges any. Please discuss. Well, I do want to talk about Robbie Lawler, Donald Cerrone, obviously, but if we get into a situation where the judges can't tell two fighters apart, then we are in much more serious trouble than we all think we are with the still work in progress that is the ringside official in mixed martial arts.
Okay, but to be fair, while watching this fight, there were moments when I caught myself being like, oh, there's Lawler's really going on the attack here, and then realizing, oh, nope, that's Cowboy. Because, I mean, it is a fair point that they do kind of look alike, especially in the swirl of a fight where it's like two bald guys of somewhat similar builds who both are in there looking pretty tan. And, yeah, when one's got his back to you or they're kind of turning around, you can get confused there for a moment. And let's just say this, the Reebok fight kits don't necessarily help. Because I think you had that one where you got one guy's in black and white and the other guy's in, like, blue and black.
Right.
Like, it's not, like, a huge difference. Whereas if you let the guys choose their own stuff, maybe you see a little bit more differentiation.
Well, better, though, now that they at least have some different color choices in there. Like, Donald Cerrone is primarily in blue trunks here and Robbie Lawler's in black. So it's not, like, quite as bad as it was when one guy would wear black with a white stripe and the other person would wear a white with a black stripe. So
yes,
you do have some differential here. Let's talk about the actual fight. Obviously, Robbie Lawler escapes with the unanimous decision 29-28 across the board. I think that we are all in agreement that Donald Cerrone wins round two here in another of what seemed like sort of what is becoming a classic Robbie Lawler taking that second round to collect himself type situation. The first round was pretty close. You arguably could have given it to Cowboy if you wanted to. And then the third round seemed like a win for Lawler. But were you surprised by the decision here? I honestly thought that this was going to be a 29-28 for Cerrone as I was watching it live.
Which two rounds did you give Cerrone?
One and two.
Really?
Yeah, because Robbie Lawler started that first round just on a blitz, but it seemed like Cowboy defended it fairly well. And then toward the end of that first round, when he was able to work from the range that he's more comfortable in, I thought he was just more impressive.
Yeah, I mean, when he took him down, he halted his momentum a little bit, but I still thought some of the work that Lawler put in the beginning of the round, you know, you don't want to make the mistake of just remembering the most what you see the last. Sure. I gave Lawler rounds 1 and 3, but I also recognize when they're both standing there listening for the judges that this one could easily go either way. But I thought it was a hell of a fight because of just watching both guys make those adjustments throughout the fight. Like you said, you know, the difference in round two is that Donald Cerrone gets that range that he wants. We talked about that one before the fight. And Lawler clearly did not want him to have that range. That's why you go out there and you get right in the guy's grill right away and try to mix it up right in front of his face, is because you know you don't want to stand there. And when Donald Cerrone could get him there, it just created a situation for Robbie Lawler where he had to pay for it on his way in, and then once he got there, Cerrone wasn't there anymore, and he had just forced him to turn around, reset, and try it all over again. And when you get out there, that man can really hurt you. But credit to Robbie Lawler for, in the third round, just kind of summoning that energy and basically by aggression and work rate, I think, taking that last round from him.
Yeah, it was a more tactical fight than perhaps we had given it credit for in the lead up. Like, everyone was excited about this because you got two real action fighters in Lawler and Cerrone about to fight each other. And everyone was just excited about the overall violence factor that was going to be happening here. But I agree with you. The thing that really I was pleasantly surprised by in this fight was the strategery and everyone's ability to make adjustments and kind of figured out what worked and to be their best selves out there in the octagon for 15 minutes while this was going down. And again, we talked a little bit about how both of these guys, Robbie Lawler and Donald Cerrone, almost exist outside the title picture because of the reputations they've been able to establish for themselves as these action fighters. And I think as a best case scenario, I think it's true. You emerge from this fight where Robbie Lawler wins, but Donald Cerrone doesn't necessarily suffer a huge setback even at welterweight, where he's looked damn good. And now, even though he's coming off these back-to-back losses, he still feels like a guy that you could match up against almost anybody and he would have a chance to win and you would get a crackerjack fight out of it.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and especially with that fight being as close as it was, nobody is walking around today going, well, Donald Cerrone is done. We've seen the best out of Donald Cerrone.
Next question this week comes to us from Eric Murphy. He writes, what time is it? What time is it? It's Ozdemir time. I'm guessing that is what Volkan was trying to get across as he pointed to his wrist 3 times after knocking out Jimmy Manoa. That or he was sponsored by Blue Tape. So this guy is a capital G guy. He has to be, right? His last 3 wins were impressive displays of kick punchery, and he has the name of a Bond villain to boot. Why am I not more excited about him? When I search my heart's brain, I'm not exactly begging for a Jones-Ozdemir matchup. What could, quote-unquote, new time, or no time, I'm sorry, do to get people more excited about him? Carrying a snake, a fun hat, making up a no-time celebration dance? Discuss Volkan.
He's halfway to a no-time celebration dance already. I love the hand gesture, especially his insistence on doing it over and over and over again until you get the damn point, because he knows that the MMA crowd is not one for subtlety, Chad. He goes out there, he gets a second straight win in the first minute of the fight, and then he's immediately pointing at his wrist, and you're like, was he injured? And then when he tells you about, oh yeah, my new nickname is No Time, and the thing I love about it, Chad, is you realize, okay, he's making the point by pointing to the place where a person would usually wear a wristwatch, but he's not wearing a wristwatch because he has no time, Chad. I love it. I am into it, even though it could kind of make, you know, not a whole lot of sense, or it could be interpreted a few different ways. I'm into all of it.
Here's the thing about Volkan Ozdemir, the great
Ozdemir?
And Ozdemir, the great and powerful Oz, as I would call him. 27 years old, native of Switzerland, 5 wins in a row now in the UFC. The last 3 over Ovin St. Preux, Misha Sirkunov, and now Jimmy Manoa, who are all well-known contenders in the UFC light heavyweight division, and back-to-back first-round knockouts. And that illustrates the current problem with the light heavyweight division, right? You got this dude, Volkan Ozdemir, who's...
Every time you say it, it's different. I love it.
Well, now you corrected me once, so now it's in my head.
No time.
Just no time.
Your boy, no time.
He should be an exciting contender in the division. And I think if you actually watch the performances, he is exciting. But at the same time, it's not like he's going to go out there and move 800,000 pay-per-view units, right? So you've basically got Jon Jones, Daniel Cormier, Alexander Gustafsson, and then Baker's dozen of dudes like that.
Okay, all right. I understand what you're saying. And again, like, especially he is on the mic afterwards saying, like, I want the winner of tonight's fight. And you're right. And like a more logically proceeding sport where one thing leads to the next, you would be like, okay, that's a reasonable request. And then Jon Jones is out there cementing himself as possibly the greatest fighter of all time and then calling out Brock Lesnar. And you got to admit that your brain goes immediately, yes, that. Like, it would be a waste right now to put Jon Jones against your boy No Time, even though I recognize that No Time has a sound argument to make in favor of that fight. But yeah, it just, part of that is that the division is ruled by a guy so far ahead of everybody else that even if you can tell me, like, this guy is one of the best in the division and I will believe you, that does not necessarily mean that it would be in any way competitive to watch him fight Jon Jones. And Jon Jones at this point feels like kind of a historic fighter to break up that what he's on right now with fighting Volkan Ozdemir at this point just seems kind of weird. And I can understand, you know, normally we would be ones to criticize someone if they, for the UFC to be like, let's go with this one that makes absolutely no goddamn sense, but we'll make a whole bunch of pay-per-view buy money over this other one where a top light heavyweight contender fights the light heavyweight champion. But I don't know. I mean, my caveman brain just gets that one. Yeah. I don't know which – maybe Volkan Ozdemir has to fight Alexander Gustafsson, has to beat one of those guys to get himself on the map.
There you go. I think you just said it right there. Gustafsson versus Ozdemir is the fight to make. And I think we'll talk about that more in round three, right? Because I think we can both agree that there's just no chance that Jon Jones fights him next.
No chance for No Time?
No chance for No Time. Anyway, that's going to do it for listener mail. If you have a question, comment, or concern that you would like to air to the Co-Main Event podcast in future weeks, you know how to do it. You go to the website, comainevent.com, and click the link in the top right-hand corner of the screen that says email the podcast. That'll get you in touch with us. While you're there, you can sign up for the Breakfast of Champions newsletter. That comes out every Monday or every Friday morning to catch you up on the news and notes that we miss while we're not recording the podcast. Stuff always happens. News always breaks. This weekend, there's a UFC fight night that we're probably not even going to get the chance to talk about on the podcast proper. So maybe the Breakfast of Champions will be a good place to go for that. As for right now, though, we are going to go ahead and get started with round number one. One this week is brought to you by our old pals at Fulton and Rourke. For a long time now, you've heard us extol the virtues of Fulton and Rourke's many fine men's grooming products, which have received rave reviews both from us here at the Co-Main Event, as well as actual heavy-hitting lifestyle publications like GQ Magazine, among other places. This week, Fulton and Rourke wanted to jump on the podcast to tell you guys about a new product, which for a short time, you can get for free when you shell out a little bit of cash to pick up another bottle of their extraordinary face wash. Ben, tell the folks at home about the new stuff.
Yeah, Fulton and Rourke's latest offering is their brand new cleansing tool, a double-sided exfoliation mitt made from 100% silicone bristles that remove dirt and oil while gently exfoliating the skin. It's perfect for the man who sports 5 o'clock shadow or the guy who, you know, just gets around to shaving about once a week, like me. But the patented cleansing tool powers through stubble to help unclog pores, improve overall complexion. The flexible, bacteria-resistant silicone material makes the cleansing tool safe to keep in the shower or pack in your dop kit. Like Chad said, you can get it for free right now if you log on to FultonandRourke.com and order up a bottle of their face wash.
I have a brand new bottle of it in my shower right now, and I swear by it. It's good stuff, I promise. Now, one thing about the cleansing tool, if you want to get it for free, you got to jump on it. Right now, through August 6th, every bottle of face wash comes with a free cleansing tool. No need to add the tool to your cart or use an extra coupon, but that offer ends approximately 1 week from now, so don't delay. Want even more reason to give Fulton and Rourke face wash a go? Use the coupon code CME to get 15% off your total purchase. Just go to FultonandRourke.com and grab some stuff today. You'll probably thank us later. Now, Ben, somehow Jon Jones and Daniel Cormier go out there in the main event of UFC 214, and they actually have a fight that appropriately brings to an end maybe the most contentious blood feud in the history of the company and or the sport. What were your impressions, I guess, of watching Jon Jones eventually knock Daniel Cormier out in the third round via head kick?
Well, my initial impressions were I was surprised at how well Daniel Cormier was doing. In those first two rounds, Cormier did not show any deference to Jones, did not show any real concern about him, was just going after him, treating him like he was any other fighter, and mixing it up on him, you know, and scoring on him. And I found myself at moments during those first two rounds kind of wondering, has Cormier figured something out, or is Jones maybe a little off his game? But yet at the same time, you're watching some of these exchanges, and you can't help but appreciate what an incredibly high-level fight this is, just in all regards. And there was a moment there, I think maybe it was in round two, where Cormier hit a trip out of the clinch. And it was an excellent trip, one of those that he is really good at. And Jones kind of corrected in the air after being tripped so that Cormier is the one who lands on his face briefly. And it kind of that one moment kind of encapsulized for me what we're seeing, how the level of MMA both guys are at. And then when you start to see Jones, I think, settle in a little more, and he catches him with that head kick, and it's such a great reminder that when you're at that kind of pinnacle for both guys, you can't slip up at all. The slightest little difference, and the next thing you know, you're face down on the mat, Big John is letting you get your head beat in.
Yeah, and it turned out to be the supremely technical fight from the probably two highest level light heavyweights that we've ever seen in this sport. A real treat, really, I think, on both sides throughout the entire thing. And you're right, you could kind of see this expression on Daniel Cormier's face throughout the entire fight, where he was just super determined and, frankly, super calm about the whole thing. Like, he didn't seem keyed up in the way that maybe he was in the first fight, even when Jones was, you know, peppering him with those weird kicks to the knee that Jones likes to throw. Daniel Cormier was just sort of very methodically walking through it and more than I expected him to be able to do, getting inside that length of Jones where he could work his boxing game. And I thought doing it really effectively.
It made Jones miss a few times. And I mean, that's what you have to do if you're going to get in there.
And even though, like, I'm going to say this about the final exchange, even though Daniel Cormier ultimately gets really badly knocked out, and I think that we will talk about that and the aftermath of that in a minute, but it was so impressive to me to see Daniel Cormier get kicked in the face. And if you watch the sequence of the stoppage a few times, it looked like Daniel Cormier would not even have fallen down had Jon Jones not been there to chase him around the cage, trying to flying knee him in the face. Like, if you imagine that this happened to Daniel Cormier while he was outside cutting the grass, like a limb breaks off a tree and hits him right in his jaw, it looked like Daniel Cormier just wanted to be like, you know what? I'm going to sit down and take a moment to collect myself.
Yeah, or not even sit down. I'm just going to stagger backwards a little bit. But yeah, but that too was a reminder of why the margin for error in a fight like that between guys like that is so slim, because Jon Jones, he sees that opportunity there, but he doesn't go crazy. For one thing, he's following Daniel Cormier around, and he's making him worry about the hands, but he's not doing a whole lot with the hands. You can see, if you go back and you watch it, you know, he's showing him the hands because he knows Daniel Cormier has to be concerned about that. And then, like, he gets him with that low leg kick to kind of trip him. And then when Cormier is kind of trying to spin around and stagger back up to his feet and gets caught up against the fence, that's when Jones comes in with that flying kind of knee kick to the body. And that's what eventually then puts Daniel Cormier down, and then Jones jumps on him, and there's just no opportunity for him to defend or really, you know, he tries to kind of sit up and get an underhook there, and that's when you're going to catch one of those patented Jon Jones elbows upside your head. And the opportunity was just never going to go to waste there for Jon Jones. People have criticized him in the past for not being a finisher, but there he is with a dangerous guy like Daniel Cormier. He sees he's got him hurt just for a second there, and there's no way he's going to let that moment slip by.
Yeah, and like the terrifying thing during that exchange is how calm and calculated Jon Jones is throughout the whole thing. I didn't even notice upon first viewing, until I went back and watched a video of the stoppage sequence again, that he tries to throw that jumping flying knee when Cormier is stumbling back against the cage. And I shudder to think what might have happened had he had that like connected with full force as he intended it. But ultimately, I think you emerge from this after a fight where both guys really put their best feet forward. Well, both guys really showed off why they're the two best in this division. Jones is the winner here, so I think it makes sense to spend a little extra time talking about him. Obviously, he came into this fight having fought just once since the last time he faced Daniel Cormier at UFC 182 back on January 3rd of 2015. And the one fight that he did have against Ovin St. Preux at UFC 197, kind of a short-notice opponent, wins by unanimous decision, but it was a performance where we all sat back and kind of thought that didn't look like the fully 100% dominant John Jones of old. He comes into this fight, first of all, looking like $1 million in the lead up to this thing, and then goes out there against Daniel Cormier, is just supremely active throughout the entire thing, especially with his kicks, using his length to try to keep Cormier off him, and ultimately becomes the first man to stop Daniel Cormier in extremely impressive fashion. It seems like if you can argue that what we're getting here is John Jones 2.0, that this newest version of Jones is even more impressive than the guy who dominated the division for so many years before he had all of his troubles.
That's right. Well, and the thing that I have to wonder, and I wrote about this a little bit in my post-fight column, was that it felt like this was Jones being pushed to become the best possible version of himself because of this rivalry and because of, you know, everything that has led up to that moment where all the personal troubles and having his title taken away, having Daniel Cormier be the guy who then gets that title. And, you know, he wanted to win that fight and wanted to win it emphatically. And I do wonder if you turn around afterwards and you tell him, all right, next up is No Time, Volkan Ozdemir, if he can get himself to get as motivated for that one. I mean, I still think he'd win, but it's like, you know, we just saw him in that fight against Ovin St. Preux where that was not the same kind of John Jones as the one we saw against Daniel Cormier. It was just different. And I have to wonder if you can't find him somebody or, you know, a series of somebodies that can cause him to dig deep, go to that same place and want it as badly as he wanted and have to be as good as he had to beat and finish Daniel Cormier, if you're going to see that same thing, or if we just might take a step backwards. Because again, people have been asking this, the entire lead up to this fight, people keep saying like, well, is this the one, if he wins this one, can we say that he's turned a corner? And I keep saying no, because the problem was never what happened inside the cage for him. That was never it. And so I don't know if you can say like, hey, he's a different guy now. He's past all that stuff, because all that stuff happened outside the cage. You will have to wait and see how his life unfolds outside the cage. And I wonder if you give him a series of opponents that he can't really get as fired up for again, if he's back to being in the nightclub a couple weeks before the fight.
Yeah, well, and the performance in this fight really tapped into that part of John Jones's brain that makes him the greatest mixed martial artist of all time, whatever that part is, where it's just like he is able to turn this fight into sort of a me against the world type situation, and he is able to use the Daniel Cormier rivalry to push himself to become better than he has ever been before. And I think you're right to ask what happens to him moving forward if he doesn't have that same fire. And it was very telling, I think, before the fight that he said things like, I need to get my life back, which tells you a little bit about how John Jones feels about all this stuff. And then after the fight, at the post-fight press conference, to say that he doesn't want to make any promises he can't keep because he's not going to be an angel and he's still a wild motherfucker, right? And throughout this whole process, it seemed like John Jones may have finally embraced the notion of showing his true self to the world.
Yeah.
Like maybe he has had enough of the bullshit and he will finally kind of come clean about who he really is.
Well, and maybe he realized he can do that and it'll work.
Is that worrying at all? Like, as mixed martial arts fans, should we get white knuckles on the edge of the desk when John Jones is saying, I'm still going to be a wild motherfucker?
Yes, but it's like the difference between, like, should you worry if you're on a plane and the pilot is drunk? Absolutely you should. But sometimes you've probably been on a plane and the pilot was drunk. You just didn't know it. So I think that's really the difference here. Now we know. You hear him say like stuff like that. You've seen what he's done in the past. It's not because before he was still trying to tell us that he was the good guy who, you know, wasn't swearing in interviews and wasn't doing all this stuff. But he was still going out and doing the stuff on the weekends anyway. So it wasn't like pretending was carrying over into his actual personal life. So if he's more honest about it now, I don't know that that necessarily makes him more of a risk. It doesn't make him less of a risk out there. But I still think it's going to take some time and that maybe you shouldn't be surprised to see some fluctuations in some of that stuff from John Jones. I don't think people want it to be like kind of a simple story where, okay, you had some problems, you did this, it's a redemption story, and now it's just smooth sailing from here on out. And I don't think that people's lives usually unfold that way. I think that it's more likely to be some ups and downs to come. You know, maybe there'll just be fewer downs or the downs won't be quite as severe. You know, he seems to realize it. Like when he's in the cage talking afterwards and he's saying, you know I haven't been an easy guy to root for all the time. He's definitely aware of, you know, his own like self-caused injuries outside of the cage. But he's also, it seems, very intent on enjoying his life as the greatest fighter on the planet. And I don't know what you think you're going to do to talk him out of that.
Well, nothing. I mean, if it goes on from here, nothing, right? And it's not just that, like, there's a risk factor involved that the pilot is drunk on the plane. It's that the pilot has been drunk before and, like, had to crash land his last flight, right? It's not necessarily just that there's a risk factor involved. It's that it feels as though John Jones is out of chances. And maybe he bought himself some more chances by going out there and being this dominant against Daniel Cormier.
What would happen? Tell me the scenario where he's finally out of chances.
Well, now that he's back on top and has that belt, and in this performance, I feel like really like solidified himself as the greatest of all time. Yeah, man, maybe he just bought himself some more rope. I don't know.
Like, well, I mean,
you can't kick him to the curb, right?
Hell no.
Scott Coker will be standing outside the hospital like the day John Jones walks out with a contract. Like, hey, John, how do you feel about fighting Linton Vassell?
He's standing there with the door to the sedan open and a big, like, fur coat that he's ready to drape over his shoulders. It's raining and he's holding an umbrella over his head. Yeah, I mean, especially right now, the situation that the UFC is in, needing to sell pay-per-view buys, having a kind of a lack of people who can reliably do it. If you sign John Jones versus Brock Lesnar for a New Year's Eve show, and 3 weeks beforehand, John Jones gets popped for DUI. I mean, is he free on bond? Can he make it to the fight physically? Because if so, the UFC is going to have him fight. It's not going to be a thing where we say, all right, fine, we finally had it with this guy. You know, he's not like the long snapper on the Minnesota Vikings here, where if he screws up, you're just going to go cut him and sign somebody else. No, you need John Jones around, and you got to think John Jones knows that you need him. And that's kind of where it seems like he's gotten himself in trouble in the past. That's why beforehand we were talking about, I said that victory might be the tougher test for him than defeat. Because like he even said about that Gustafsson fight, was that he was feeling like he was so untouchable that nobody could possibly fuck with him. That even if he didn't train hard, he's going to go out there and beat these guys. And he almost did that to himself to kind of test that theory, to see if he could really do that. It would be not that difficult for me to imagine that a win like this puts him right back in a similar place.
We'll just have to wait and see, I guess. Fingers crossed. You wonder, are you fucking kidding me?
Yeah.
And then we'll move on to round number two. Ben, you have been talking up Tanya Evinger's social media game for a while on the podcast now.
It's true.
So I wanted to bring up as part of my Are You Fucking Kidding Me this week, Brandon Schaub, who we all know, former UFC heavyweight who's reinvented himself a little bit here as a commentator on the television.
Also apparently a stand-up comedian.
Yeah,
people keep saying that he's funny, and I keep trying to find footage, and I can't find it, but people who've seen him say he's actually funny.
He goes on the Twitter machine on July 29th, a couple days ago, and tweets, "Anyone feel sorry for Tanya Evinger before this fight even begins? Kind of half-frowny face emoji, hashtag UFC 214. Tanya Evinger, at 1:34 p.m. July 30th, so the day after her fight with Chris Cyborg, gets on the Twitter machine and replies to Brendan Schaub with no punctuation, which I think is key to this. Shut up, stupid.
The no punctuation is key. I'm assuming no capitalization either. It's all lowercase.
Yeah. Are you fucking kidding me? Ben, you were right about Tanya Evinger's social media presence. She's amazing.
I tried to tell you. I'm not surprised, motherfucker. That's what I have to say to you. Chad, my, are you fucking kidding me? So afterwards, Tyron Woodley, you know, he's not too happy about all the shit he's being asked to eat in the immediate aftermath of his successful UFC welterweight title defense. And in kind of making his case, he compared himself to other champions who do not defend their belts as often or at all or against the top contenders, made some of the similar points you did, and made good points. Then, though, in talking about how it seems like maybe it's going to be George St. Pierre and Michael Bisping instead of George St. Pierre and Tyron Woodley, he makes this turn. So if it's not George St. Pierre, let him run. But guess what? Whoever you put in front of me, I'm going to run through them. I'm going to beat them. And if he does not fight me, by default, I will be the best welterweight of all time. Dude, are you fucking kidding me?
You fucking kidding me?
You can't become the best welterweight of all time by default. As soon as you say the words, by default, I become the best welterweight of all time, you should realize how unimpressive that would sound if it even happened like that. You fucking kidding me?
You fucking kidding me? Well, that's going to do it for round number one. We'll be right back with round number two.
Well, Chad, on the other side of greatness lies heartbreak. We talked about how awesome John Jones was, how incredibly impressive it was when he was forced by his greatest rival to ascend to a higher plane, and that greatest rival got crushed in a kind of just heartrending fashion. Daniel Cormier goes out there, the first two rounds, looking good, wins round two on two of the three judges' scorecards. It seems like he is just growing in confidence as the fight is going on. Then he catches that one head kick, a tendency that the Jones camp said that they had identified before, a tendency that in previous video it seemed like Daniel Cormier realized he had and realized could be a problem. And then the next thing you know, he's unconscious and doesn't really know what's going on. There's a lot of different things to talk about here. First of all, let's start with, where does this leave Daniel Cormier now?
Well, it leaves Daniel Cormier in kind of a tough spot, really, Ben. Because despite the fact that he has defeated everyone else under the sun besides John Jones, it's difficult to plot a really good course forward for him at 205 pounds. The man is 38 years old at this point. He's been competing in one manner of sport for his entire life. So you feel like if Daniel Cormier decided that this was it for him and he wanted to walk away, that wouldn't be unexpected. And in fact, I think it would be pretty understandable. However, I don't know if you read the Greg Howard feature, really good Greg Howard feature.
That the New York Times,
on Daniel Cormier and the New York Times this past week. Part of that was sort of about how Daniel Cormier felt lost in between his wrestling career and then really dedicating himself to mixed martial arts. He talked a lot about how without that competition in his life, he really felt lost. And so that is the kind of thing that makes you feel like Daniel Cormier will probably soldier on here in his MMA career, at least a little bit longer. And so then you, if that's the case, you face this decision, this question, whether, let's say John Jones goes to heavyweight. Let's say he goes to heavyweight to fight Brock Lesnar. That may be a one-off thing. It may be a permanent move for Jones to go up to 265. If that happens, is it good enough for Daniel Cormier to stay at 205 and perhaps continue being the champion there, even though we all know he got smoked two times by Jones? And or is it a viable opportunity for him to go up to heavyweight, even though that may or may not be where his the only guy who's ever beat him makes his living?
Well, you know, listening to Jones talk about that, the idea of going up to heavyweight, I did not get the sense that he felt like that's where his life was going to be. Was that heavyweight? Sounded to me like, you know, he talks like he doesn't even really want to consider fighting Stipe Miocic for the heavyweight belt. He just wants a big money fight up at heavyweight because he saw Conor McGregor do it, and he realized how that could be an awesome thing that you can do to really get yourself to that next level. I don't get the sense that he is going to stay there, though, so that's why I would think that Daniel Cormier could move up in weight. I mean, then he'd also have the problem, though, of Cain Velasquez, your buddy and your training partner, is there, but he's hurt so often. Who knows how viable it even is for him to launch a serious run at the UFC heavyweight title again. You know, also, though, at 38, I could see that Daniel Cormier might be able to transition out of fighting this point and not find himself in that same kind of unmoored lost position. Because I've talked to him about that time in his life too, when it, you know, after the failed bid the second time around the Olympics. And it's a very different situation because that time, as I recall him telling me, he was working for like a local TV news station selling ad time, basically. And like the only competitive outlet he had was the company softball team. And he was like, you know, drinking every night and falling asleep at his desk for his lunch hour. Like that's a different situation than working as a broadcaster. You're already, you got some money, you know, you're not necessarily in the doldrums of despair the same way you would have been back then. But I also can understand how a guy that is that competitive doesn't want to go out like that. You know, if you feel like you still got something left, and obviously he does, like you said, he can beat up most people. I can understand how he would tell himself, like, okay, I got to keep doing something. I still have the power. I want to put it to work. I would rather see him do it at heavyweight, though, just because if he stays as one of those big three at light heavyweight, you're not going to give the Volkan Ozdemirs to Daniel Cormier because he's probably just going to beat him, and then where are you? You know, the UFC does not really like to do that. They don't like guys who are hanging around there who are just going to block future contenders from becoming somebody who can challenge for the title. So you're just kind of in the way at that point. And I don't think there's a whole lot of interest in seeing a third Cormier-Jones fight.
Yeah, and I guess I should note here that there are some reports out right now, not necessarily from big sites, but that Cain Velasquez versus Stipe Miocic is on in the works for UFC 216, which I think would be, in my opinion, both a surprising fight booking and a fight booking that could potentially cut down on the options for Daniel Cormier. So we'll have to see how that goes. What about after the fight, Ben, where John Jones reconciled a bit with Daniel Cormier on the mic? I feel like a lot of times you see guys engage in these like really bitter rivalries, and then after the fight where they act like they're brothers and all has been forgiven, it feels disappointing. It feels like you got worked a little bit as the you know, the pay-per-view buying public. Didn't get that impression here, I think, because you knew that this was a very real problem, very real animosity that existed between Daniel Cormier and John Jones. And so in this case, Jones turns over a new leaf a little bit in this post-fight interview and says that Daniel Cormier is a man that he emulates and a man that he wants to try to be like. I felt like that actually was a really heartfelt and nice gesture from Jones, and a gesture that I think rehabilitated the image of Daniel Cormier a little bit, kind of on the spot. Depending on what Cormier feels like he wants to do next, I feel like having Jones say those things about him actually gave him a little boost coming out of this knockout loss. Did you feel that way? Did you feel like that it was positive to see Jones make that turnaround?
Yeah, and I don't know if it was even such a dramatic turnaround based on some of the stuff he said before the fight. We have it on the MMA Junkie Instagram page where there is a video from, I think, either the open workouts or Media Day, something where John Jones is standing there and he is talking about how he likes Daniel Cormier in a way. And, you know, and doing the new John Jones version of it where I believe he's saying, like, Daniel Cormier, I think he's a fucking good dude. He has good friends and shit. He's funny. He's a fucking good dude. I mean, he says fucking like five times about this thing. But and this seemed like a sincere kind of source of confusion for John Jones. He was saying, I don't understand why he can't just admit that he is fucking with a dude who is like the king of this era and that he's older. I'm younger. I came into this game at a younger point. He's kind of aging out of it and this is my time. And hey, he's the baddest motherfucker in the world outside of John Jones. Why can't he just be comfortable with that? He seemed to legitimately not understand. Like, why can't he just accept that I'm better and I'm always going to be better and just be happy with that because second place is still really, really good? And it reminded me of something like, do you ever see that 30 for 30 about Larry Holmes and Muhammad Ali when Larry Holmes put that just terrible beating on an aging Muhammad Ali who probably should not have even been licensed to fight him? And I believe it was maybe when they were kind of catching up with them modern day after they have a whole bunch of footage from them in training camp. And Larry Holmes is talking about how when he had been younger and Muhammad Ali had been at the top of his game, he had been a paid sparring partner for Ali and how everybody thought Ali was this great guy. And he was saying, you know, if he's up there and you're down here, he thinks you're the greatest guy in the world. He'll be super nice to you. He'll be that funny, charismatic Ali that the public knows. He'll treat you super well. You'll think, man, what an amazing guy. But if you try to be on the same level as him, then he hates you. And then he becomes a real son of a bitch. And the kind of guy that the side of him that other people don't really see. And it seemed like that same kind of thing. Like, as long as you can recognize that John Jones is the greatest and he is above you, John Jones can be your buddy. But the moment you try to be on that his level or above him, that's when a different side of it comes out. That's what I thought we're seeing there. When after he's knocked out Daniel Cormier, then he could say, I really like the guy, I respect him. And he was saying that stuff before, but then he could really make us believe it. And I think it was sincere. I don't think it was him trying to get some fans, as Greg Jackson would say. I think that he really meant that stuff. But I also think it was way easier for him to say it after he'd just knocked the guy unconscious.
The aftermath of this thing is as heartbreaking and arguably as ugly as you will ever see in this sport. And I think part of the reason that it was because Daniel Cormier is such a fucking good dude. Really hard to see him both almost incoherent in the moments after the knockout where he's arguing with everybody, doesn't really understand why the fight was stopped because he clearly doesn't even remember that he had been knocked out. And then, like, kind of heartbreaking to see him try to have an interview in the cage with Joe Rogan where Daniel Cormier is just crying, just bawling, basically, because in my opinion, there's probably a lot of emotions for Daniel Cormier there going beyond the simple fact that he just got concussed. You know, this is kind of like the story of his life, that he has always been really, 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 really good, just never the best. And, like, to get knocked out in this fashion by John Jones must have been psychologically for him kind of a watershed moment of realizing maybe I'm always going to be the runner-up, you know? And so I think he was probably trying to process all that. Joe Rogan obviously apologized for even having the interview both on the UFC 214 pay-per-view and again on social media the next day. I feel like Rogan actually handled it pretty well. I don't necessarily know that he deserves the criticism that he has been getting, but just a tough thing to watch from Daniel Cormier's side.
And also, I don't know if you saw like the video where from like one of the cameras that stayed kind of isolated on him after he's, you know, he gets helped up and he's clearly kind of confused and they're trying to do a thing where they're trying to like restrain him and get him down on the stool and he doesn't want to. He tries to leave the cage and they block him. They physically block him from leaving the cage. And I'm curious about that because if you're doing that because like as an athletic commission, I can understand how you maybe don't want that guy to try to walk down the metal stairs right at that moment. Like that would be a legitimate thing. You know, he's kind of a risk to even be walking around. You want somebody there in case he falls down again. Okay, but if you're doing it because you want him to be able to stand there for TV with Big John while we do the hand-raising ceremony, then that is fucking indefensible. Because that's a guy who clearly he needs some medical attention at that point. He's just been concussed, basically, just been knocked out. And if he wants to get out of there and go to the back and see a doctor, then you probably need to let him do that and not make him stand around for the pageantry aspect of it, which is completely unnecessary. And also the whole time you're watching it and the athletic commission people are in there trying to get him to like trying to force him to sit down and you're going, where's his team? Why don't you let his team in there and let Javier Mendez, somebody he trusts, get in there and try to help him and deal with him? It seems like you'll have a much better chance of, you know, getting a reaction that you want out of him. And as far as like the interview aspect, I know like it always is problematic if you're going to try and interview a dude who's just knocked out. At the same time, I can see that there is something to giving him an opportunity to talk if he wants to, because, you know, maybe sometimes that might be an important time where he wants, if he wants to retire or something at that time, you know, you can always say, hey, he could say what he wants to say in the back. He could say what he wants to say tomorrow, but it's not going to have the same impact as if you get to say it on the broadcast. I don't know. Maybe there is a way to like let the guy have the opportunity to talk without going in there and shoving the microphone in his face and trying to just straight up interview him. But yeah, it was just hard stuff to watch, especially because like you said, he's a fucking good dude.
Whatever happens with Daniel Cormier, I'm sure that we all wish him the best. Exactly what his next move will be remains to be seen, but we will find out when it is time to let that be known. As for right now, though, we are going to move on to round number 3. Well, Ben, after Daniel Cormier's heartbreaking interview with Joe Rogan inside the cage at UFC 214, John Jones gets the mic back as if there was something he forgot to do.
Oh, yeah.
And he says the following. Brock Lesnar, if you want to know what it feels like to get your ass kicked by a guy who weighs 40 pounds less than you, meet me in the octagon.
Ooh, and then mic drop. And you just hear the mic go, thump, thump.
Now, Ben, the normally silent Brock Lesnar responds to this challenge via the Associated Press's Greg Beecham a day later by saying, be careful what you wish for, young man.
I think it was that night he actually responded, yeah.
So it's on, as far as I'm concerned, and I guess I'll just throw it to you. Jones versus Lesnar, are you in favor?
I kind of hate myself, but yes.
I could not be more in favor of this fight.
Do you at least hate yourself for it?
No, I love it.
Not
I
at
love,
all?
Love everything about it. In fact, I'm surprised that there are people out there in the mixed martial arts world that are like, John Jones versus Brock Lesnar? Meh. Right? There are people doing that, and it blows my mind.
I don't know. Are they really saying meh, as in not at all excited or interested?
There are people that don't want this.
You know,
that's out there. That's a thing that's happening.
The same way if you're like, who wants to go for ice cream? There's going to be some people who are like, I don't want to because they are on a diet or whatever. Or, you know, they just don't want to have sugar after 9 p.m. or
that's
something.
I'm still going to feel like that's foreign to me, man.
I understand that. And I'm with you there. I'm going to go for ice cream. And I might regret it afterwards. I might have to admit that it was not the better angels of my nature taking over when I said, you know, go ahead, throw another scoop and some sprinkles on that bitch. But I recognize that we're living in a certain age when it comes to MMA right now. We've kind of, I think, changed our mindset about what this really is and let it be to some extent what it always was. And if you throw an idea out there like that and just the impulse center in my brain is just like, yes, gimme, then I have to realize that there's going to be a lot of people who watch that and who want to see it. Like we said, you know, Volkan Ozdemir might make a whole lot of more sense from like just a logical progression standpoint, and yet there's no way I could say it would be better for everybody involved, for the sport, for you know, that the health even of the UFC's bottom line, for John Jones to go ahead and do that fight and leave all this potential money on the table.
Here's the thing about Brock Lesnar versus John Jones, though, at least in my opinion. Not only is it the right fight to make promotionally, because I got to think it would shatter the UFC all-time pay-per-view record. I think it would probably top McGregor against Nate Diaz and be the number one best-selling UFC pay-per-view of all time. I feel like it makes a ton of sense athletically also, because if you distill mixed martial arts down to its essential nature, what this thing was when it started, Brock Lesnar against Jon Jones is almost the perfect MMA fight, because you have in one corner the greatest fighter of all time, the young guy who's incredibly skilled, incredibly cerebral, who comes from the best team and is an impeccable game planner and is meticulous and is mean-spirited and is ready to go out there and do whatever it has to be done to be the greatest of all time. And in the other corner, you have just a fucking mountain and a dude who is a farm boy who is just going to go out there, put his head down, and try to juggernaut through whatever comes out of him. And he's going to outweigh John Jones by at least 40 pounds, like Jones says. That, to me, is fascinating. I would love to watch that fight, even from just a physical standpoint, because, honestly, I have no idea what would happen.
John Jones just fucking runs through him is what happens.
Maybe.
Yes.
Maybe. And John Jones is more skilled, better rounded, obviously the better fighter. But the thing about Brock Lesnar is that fights that he's in are very seldom determined by who is more skilled or who is the better fighter.
Well, I don't know about that, because I think that the thing you saw happen to Brock Lesnar when he got past some of those initial fights against guys like Heath Herring and Randy Couture and stuff is that he ran up against more skilled fighters who beat the shit out of him.
Sure, but also the people that he beat were also more skilled than Brock Lesnar.
Okay,
Randy Couture
sure.
is a more skilled fighter than Brock Lesnar.
Right, but
Frank Mir is a more skilled fighter than Brock Lesnar. Brock Lesnar fought Frank Mir in his second professional fight, right? Frank, we can
well,
all
he,
agree.
And he
that,
lost that one, but yeah.
That, yeah, and then he comes back, but like when he fought Frank Mir at UFC 100, Frank Mir is still the more skilled fighter.
Sure.
And in fact, in that fight, Brock Lesnar gets Frank Mir in a position that in the theory of martial arts should not be that dangerous of a position. And he is able to just turn his face into hamburger because Brock Lesnar, Nell Lesnar, is not a human being. He's like a fucking monster. Like
okay.
A literal monster from my nightmares.
Let me calm you down with a couple facts, my friend.
Are you going to correct me on a fact?
I'm going to correct you on
Alistair
some facts.
Over him?
First of all, how old is Brock Lesnar now? 40?
He's 40. He just turned 40, I think.
Okay. So already time is working against him. The longer it takes to put together this fight, the worse it's going to be for Brock Lesnar. I understand he's not like a regular person 40. He's not like an us 40. You know, he's still going to be a Brock Lesnar 40. But then he's still going to go up against a John Jones 28 or whatever. And
John Jones is 30.
Okay,
he's
fine.
He's 30.
But Jesus Christ, that's worse for you than John Jones at 28.
Brock Lesnar just turned 40 on July 12th.
And Brock Lesnar, you know, is going to, if he does take this fight, he's going to be in it for the payday. He's not going to be in it because he wants to get back on top in the mixed martial arts world. He is going to do his thing where he sets up his own, like, private training camp and gets in his own sparring partners who are not going to be trying to throw the hardest ham hocks they can at the big man's head for, you know, $100 a day or whatever it is that they're getting out there. He's going to do the same thing that got him in trouble before as far as training-wise. He's still not going to like getting punched in the face. He's still not going to handle that well. He's probably just going to go out there and try to be like, all right, I'm a freak athlete, and that's my best chance, and so I'll just rely on that. And John Jones is going to kick him right in his tummy, right in his tum-tum, and Brock Lesnar's not going to like it. I mean, maybe there's a chance that, yeah, sure, maybe, you know, you rev up the engine on the Mack truck and you run over the guy. But if that doesn't work, and it's the chances are much higher that it's not going to work, then Brock Lesnar just gets tooled up. I don't think it's going to be a terribly competitive fight, but I understand the appeal of it, that you have a guy who just, like, just sheer size, power, and, like, mysteriousness about him that's going to get people interested, especially if you put him up against a smaller guy who also happens to be the best in the world. Fine, I get it. I get the appeal. But I also think that this is a different shade of McGregor Mayweather and not a completely different thing. You know, it's Brock Lesnar has more like MMA experience, of course, than McGregor has boxing experience. But I think there's still going to be a huge, like, competitive difference between these two. And I don't think it's going to matter as far as, like, generating interest in the fight.
Everything you just said is true. And I feel like the opening line on this fight, which I believe had John Jones something like a 3-1 favorite, is right. If I had to pick this thing, I would probably pick John Jones based on everything that we have said through the first 8 minutes of this round. But if you also told me that it turned out that Brock Lesnar was just too damn big, and that he went out there and blew through John Jones's matchstick legs and put him on the ground and knocked him out with one punch that dribbled his head off the mat, I would also believe that. That's all I'm saying. And the thing about Brock Lesnar that has always been true, and I think that it will be true at 40 years of age, is that he makes the margin of error so slim in a fight that, like, you can make one mistake and it can be over. And in fact, that's what happened to Randy Couture, who obviously is not John Jones. But Randy Couture in their fight was doing pretty well, right? Kind of holding his own with Brock Lesnar. And then he sees this punch coming. He tries to slip it. But it turns out that Brock Lesnar's arms are just so damn long.
Yeah, they just keep going.
That it got there anyway, just clipped Randy Couture behind the ear and dropped him. And then Brock Lesnar got on top of him. A couple, three, four, five hammer fists. Next thing you know, Brock Lesnar is the UFC heavyweight champion.
The difference is that Randy Couture then was a lot closer to the age that Brock Lesnar is now.
I'm merely saying, if you told me that that's how it went down, I would believe you.
This is how they're going to sell these pay-per-views, is to mark motherfuckers like you, who some part of you has watched Brock Lesnar, the pro wrestler, over the years, and so, you know it's not real, but some part of you thinks that it is.
Yeah, go ask Frank Mir if it's real, man. Go ask Randy
Are you
Couture.
Saying it's
ask
real to
Shane,
me?
Ask Shane Carwin if it's real. Go
should,
ask him.
Should I ask The Taker, too?
You know, if they want to use portions of this podcast to sell this pay-per-view, we would sell them outtakes for a very reasonable price.
Yeah, get at us. Get at our business manager, also known as Chad's wife.
All right, let's do Just Saying Stuff, Ben, and then we will get out of here for this week. Ben, what's your Just Saying Stuff?
Well, Chad, you know, we talked about the roast beef and the key lime pie, and it seems like what we just saw here this past weekend at UFC 214 Like, this is kind of the best MMA could probably offer us this year. Definitely the best it could offer us up till this point in this year. Made all those other long Fox Sports 1 nights worth it to get to see some real, just high-level MMA action of all different types. You realize how great it is. And now you're going to turn around on August 5th in Mexico City at Arena Ciudad de Mexico. And what do you got? You got yourself a 6-fight main card on Fox Sports 1, headlined by Sergio Pettis versus Brandon Moreno.
Big Serge!
You got Randa Markos and Alexa Grasso in the co-main event, Chad. You got a couple of people without Wikipedia pages on the main card. You got fucking Sam Alvey versus Rashad Evans on the main card somehow, but it's like the second fight in to the main card.
That should be the main event, right? Rashad Evans versus Sam Alvey, kinda?
I'm just saying, we hit kind of a high water mark probably for this year in the UFC this last weekend. And now we plummet back to reality right there in Mexico City. I'm just saying.
Just saying. Well, it can't all be key lime pie, Ben. But speaking of tasty dessert, you know my man Brian Ortega was in action this past weekend at UFC 214. And you know he advanced to 12-0.
Key City, what?
Undefeated still as a mixed martial artist. I'm going to tell you this, Ben. 4 stoppage victories in a row for Brian Ortega, all of them in the 3rd round. They call the 4th and 5th round the championship rounds. That 3rd round is the T-City round, baby. I'm just saying. T-City round.
Just saying. That's a hell of a fight, too. You listen to those guys just swanging and banging on each other.
Nothing not to like about Brian Ortega except for the positive test for drostanolone.
Except for that.
Back in 2014.
That was, you know, a little bit too much T-City.
Just saying.
The wrong kind of T-City, maybe?
Anyway, that's going to do it for this week's co-main event podcast. We will be back next week ostensibly to talk about this UFC fight night headlined by Sergio Pettis versus Brian Moreno?
Brandon Moreno. So
I
close.
Was close, though.
I saw the look on your face, and I was like, he's not going to get it.
I was close, man.
He's not going to get
there. I was close enough. Anyway, that's going to do it for this week. We are done. We are through. We are out.
Do you remember any other fights I mentioned from that card?
Well, Sam Alvey against Rashad Evans. Okay. I remember that one.
What was the other one I mentioned?
Randa Markos and Alexa Grasso.
Look at you. You can remember things.